Well, since she's not here, I'd like to maybe ask Dr. Davis, who has been on the Commonwealth Transportation Board for several years, and just stepped off and has been ended up being replaced. Or I'm saying he's actually did his time on the CTB and just recently came off the board. And Dr. Davis, you'd like to maybe say a few words?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary and members of the CTB. It's a great pleasure to welcome you back to Winchester again 4 years later. I hope my dates are correct. We're delighted that you've come to our community to take a look at all the projects that we've been working on for many years here in the area. I had the great honor and pleasure of visiting in many of your districts as well to see the work that CTB and VDOT does. So today I hope the welcome that you receive you'll enjoy, and that any time you're coming back through this part of the Commonwealth that you'll stop and visit with us. Mr. Secretary, thank you for my opportunity of service on the boards, and I know you'll enjoy working with Dixon Whitworth, who has taken my place, and he'll represent this district well. Thank you very much.
Jim, thank you very much for your service on the board. Dixon, since you're the newest member and we're here in your district, would you like to maybe just say a few words?
Other than the fact that Dr. Davis leaves big shoes to be filled in more ways than one, I look very much forward to working with my colleagues here and representing the wonderful Stanton District, and I appreciate the confidence that the governor has placed in me and serving the Commonwealth.
Dixon, thank you very much, and welcome aboard. At this point, we're going to get right into the workshop versus financial report. Mr. Lawson.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. This morning, I'm going to hit two high points. This morning, I want to give you a kind of a wrap up on how things ended in 2012. I've given you a preliminary 2012 report. I wanted to give you a final now that we have closed 2012, and then I'll give you an update on performance through August for 2013. State transportation revenue in 2012 ended up at 2.9% greater than previous fiscal year, which was exceeded forecast of 2.2%. Is that better? The motor vehicle sales and gas tax exceeded the forecast by almost double. We had estimated 4.2% and it came in at 9.1%. As you see, the auto sales were strong over the full year. Motor fuel tax collections were down from previous year by 1.3%, which was, while a decrease, slightly better than forecast. Sales and use tax were up 5.4%, just about equal with the revenue forecast. And federal collections for 2012 were $32 million greater than 2011. This chart gives you the illustration of the major state revenue sources. You can see here the 2012 estimate, how the actuals for 2012 compared, and how that compares to the actual collections in 2011. I want to point out here that in the bottom line, the miscellaneous taxes, fees, and revenues, I think you had some discussion yesterday about weigh stations. The fines associated with overweight vehicles represent about $7 million of that $12 million number. We spent $4.1 billion in fiscal year 2012, which is about $500 million more than we had spent in 2011. 52% of the spending was related to maintenance, 43% related to VDOT's maintenance program, 9% for the financial assistance payments to localities. Construction spending represented 34% of our spending. At the end of the year, we had $2.7 billion in contracts outstanding, which was about $300 million more than the prior fiscal year. And we, of that $2.7 billion, about $1.3 was outstanding contract value. This graphic just gives you the year-over-year comparison of the spending between of the major programs. And you can see here most of the programs are very consistent year-over-year, with the exception of maintenance and construction that did see the growth in spending. In terms of maintenance, we finished up the year strong, had spent just over $200 million in June for a year-to-date spending of $1.8 billion. This was a record spending in the maintenance program, as we spent $362 million more than we did last year, bringing down that maintenance balance from $485 million to $177. Construction, again, as you saw, we spent about 11% more than we had the year before, $1.4 billion. This is just the overall the spending chart. And you can see just from a perspective of year over year of the year, we were $72 million shy of forecasted spending, which is only about a 2%, but only about a 2% difference. Cash balance, looking at cash position from where we began the year to where we ended the year, the increase you see of about $400 million is largely related to the bond proceeds that we sold toward the end of the year. Jumping on into fiscal year 13, and through August, we are seeing revenues looking strong, almost 10% greater than the prior fiscal year. It's kind of hard to make a comparison against the forecast of 2.2% because we always have very strong revenues during the summer months. Good to see that motor vehicle sales and use tax do continue to grow, again, almost 10% over where we were this time last year. We are seeing motor fuels tax collections continue to grow. This is a trend that will continue. And state sales and use taxes are also doing well this time of the year. Again, this graphic just gives you the comparison of the 2013 estimate, the 2013 year-to-date through August, and what was collected comparatively in 2012. Federal spending, we're significantly up at this point this year, $360 million collected. A very large portion of this is related to some maintenance conversions that have been done, collecting federal revenues on some funding, some work that was done previously. In terms of spending, we spent about $800 million through August, about $200 million more than through August of last year. It's pretty much split, about 45% related to maintenance and 45% related to construction. Our current outstanding contracts are about $2.8 billion, again with about $1.3 billion outstanding contract value. Year over year, you can see the comparisons. Again, most of the programs are pretty consistent. And you can certainly see the increased spending activity in maintenance and construction. In terms of the maintenance program, we spent $183 million in August. We've spent about $340 so far this year. Our anticipated spending in the maintenance program is $1.6 billion this year, which is less than the spending last year. And that reduction is due to the fact that we brought down the maintenance balance significantly to where the carryover was much smaller. And based on our current spend plans, we're only projecting about a $14 million unspent allocation balance at the end of 2013. It is still a preliminary forecast, but it's very clear that the spending and balance for this year will be quite small. In terms of construction, we've again spent about $342 million this year. A large part of this increase is spending activity associated with downtown Midtown Tunnel. Just our anticipated spending chart. Obviously, we're just getting the year off to a start, but you can see here that we plan to spend about $3.9 billion this fiscal year. From a cash balance perspective, our cash position is just about the same as where we began the year. This is a product of, we had additional bond sales that were done in July, and when you include the bond sales and the normal revenues that come in, which is just slightly greater than the revenues or the expenditures that we incurred. And just kind of wrapping up, as I mentioned, the trust fund revenues are looking strong so far this year, but don't want to get anybody to get too carried away thinking that's a good trend for the year, because it's just too early to say that. In terms of spending this year, we're off to a good start. Our spending is in line with our forecasted spending. We are seeing strong activity in construction and maintenance, and we think we've reached the point that where we will have a reasonable balance this year in the maintenance program.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yes,
Mr. Lawson. I'd like to say, since I've been with somebody that's been not critical but interested in the balances, it's really nice to see these balances coming down on the maintenance side and others, getting the money on the street and getting the projects done. So I salute you all, whole organization, for doing that. If you could go back to slide 5 for a minute. I'm confused about something. We're showing our final 52% maintenance on $4.1 billion, right? Is that what that says? Expenditures 4.1, approximately 52% of maintenance. And then you go to slide 7 and it says we spent 1.77 on maintenance. That's not 52% of 4.1.
The 52% is of the core programs. I can show you how we computed it.
Okay, so you're taking some stuff out of the 4.1. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Secretary?
Yeah, Mr. Krasinski.
Mr. Lawson, can you amplify a little bit on how the bond sales went? Everything smooth there? And
yes, sir. We had, of course, we've had several issues this year. Two refundings, three refundings and two issues, CPR bonds and Garvey bonds. Both came in. Everything has come in very good. And in fact, when we look at all the issues that we've done over the last year, and you average it out, cost of money is about 2.7%. So we've had very, very good, been received very well in the markets.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Rich.
For FY 2012, the expenditures were $4.1 billion. What percentage of that was debt?
Debt service is about $250 million.
$250? And what if we have a rough winter this year? How do we deal with that? Do we have a contingency fund? Or?
There are some emergency monies available for to help address, you know, snow and other emergency efforts. And then, as always, you know, if things come in bad, we reprogram, replan our activities in order to compensate.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes, one more.
Yes.
For example, on slide 12, when you talked about the sales use tax, but more precisely at the end where you said we should not assume that the income is going to be as good as it looks right now. Are there any trends or models or anything in particular that make us think that we can hang our hat on to know that to expect it to go down and not perform quite as well?
No. I just the point I wanted to make sure we don't get too excited in thinking that these high numbers will continue, because we always have stronger revenue numbers in during the summer months. Once we get to September or October, you can start to see whether we're continuing to follow our patterns. It's good to see that year over year the numbers are up, but you know, at 13% through August, with a forecast of 5% roughly, you know, by next year at the end of the year, I don't want people to think that we'll see that 13% kind of hold.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Mr. Lawson, thank you very much. We have a presentation now on the short line rail. Mr. Clement here. I'd like to welcome Mr. Whit Clement, former Secretary of Transportation and also former Chairman of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Mr. Clement, how are you? I'm over here.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the CTB. Thank you very much for giving the Short Line Railroads an opportunity to bring you up to date on the role that they play in Virginia in our transportation infrastructure. What I would also like to say at the outset that we have with us Mr. Gail Wilson. And Gail, if you would stand. Gail is an officer with the Buckingham Branch Railroad, a short line, very large short line, the largest in Virginia, down in Dilwyn, Appomattox County. And Gail has been president of the association for the last several years. What we hope to do today is to give you a brief overview, and those are the topics that we hope to cover. We're going to look at who the short lines are, why they are important, and how the state and the short lines partner with each other, and then some closing comments about our concerns in their future in helping to serve the economic development needs of Virginia. The short lines railroads, there are nine. There are only nine of them in Virginia. They did bind together as an association mainly for the purpose of raising their profile and helping to educate legislators and other policymakers like yourself. That's a list of the short lines. They are scattered throughout Virginia. Tend to be more in the rural areas, but certainly not exclusively. They operate often over routes that the Class 1 railroads like Norfolk Southern and CSX haven't found profitable enough to maintain their lines. But nevertheless, the tracks that the short lines do operate on are critical to a lot of different pockets in different areas within Virginia. They do cover relatively short distances, but you'll see cumulatively over 500 miles of track. We estimate about 150 customers, and we did a survey several years ago that shows the payroll and the annual operating cost of the short lines. They haul a variety of goods and products in different parts of Virginia. They also have connections with the port and will frequently work with the Class 1s in getting the goods and supplies either to or from the ports and distribution centers. Hope to show over the next several slides why short lines are important and why the several rail funds that the Transportation Board has jurisdiction over, why they are justified and important. There are at least five reasons or benefits that the public policy in Virginia has been to encourage the continued viability of not just short lines, but of freight rail and more recently, passenger rail. Economic development, very critical piece in certain areas within Virginia. Short lines are an alternative carrier to the heavy trucks that frequently can't get into some of the more isolated areas. Short lines help to not only create but to perpetuate the jobs in a number of different areas. And you see there the examples in Buckingham County, the Eastern Shore. Eastern Shore, the Bay Coast Railroad carries liquefied petroleum gas that cannot otherwise get across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. A second reason or benefit is pretty obvious, I think, to most people. If you look at the alternative of heavy trucks, short lines help to reduce highway maintenance costs. The Transportation Research Board estimates that one heavy truck is equivalent to about 90 passenger cars in terms of the impact on highway maintenance cost. And I know maintenance is a big issue for you, and short lines do their part in minimizing those costs. One slide is not in here, and that's to help reduce highway congestion. I think that's all pretty obvious in getting heavy trucks off of the road. And in doing so, a fourth benefit, in addition to the third one of highway congestion reduction, is to help reduce air pollution. Interesting that Norfolk Southern, in their study on the Crescent Corridor, their people have opined that diverting 700,000 long-haul trucks into the Crescent Corridor reduces carbon dioxide by 110,000 tons each year. A fifth benefit is that the short lines help to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Interesting that a railroad can move a ton of freight 480 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. There are, nevertheless, as with all our different modes, challenges that the short lines face. One is just the plain inherent inequality if you were to compare a railroad with the heavy truck. Railroads must compete with trucks that operate on public highway systems, and yet railroads have to make the investments to acquire or lease their track and make investments in the private rail structure. It's very capital intensive. It really is not a level playing field, but the freight lines, freight rail lines recognize that, and nevertheless very, very interested in being a part of Virginia's overall transportation network, and as a result of that and the state's recognition of their role, there are four rail funds that you have jurisdiction over, established by the General Assembly. And very briefly, we would like to review those with you. There are four funds. The first one is the Rail Enhancement Fund. Then the Rail Preservation Fund, and that's the one that's most important to these nine short lines. And then a Rail Industrial Access Fund, and then a new initiative of Governor McDonald, the Inner City Passenger and Rail Operating Capital Fund. In theory, short lines benefit from those first three, but as a practical matter, it is the Rail Preservation Fund, and to some extent, that third one, the Rail Industrial Access Fund. You have the ability to also send more transportation dollars to rail, from which the short line railroads would benefit. The governor's discretionary opportunity fund. There's provisions in there for assisting railroads with new industrial prospects in Virginia. You could even take 10% of the highway funds for rail if there is evidence of mitigating highway congestion. And then a third pot of funds, and I'm not sure it's actually funded right now, it has been in the recent past, is the TPOP, the Transportation Partnership Opportunity Fund. The first one, the Rail Enhancement Fund was established in 2005. It provides about $23 million annually for freight and passenger rail improvements, and the money is derived from the motor vehicle rental car tax. 3% of that is dedicated into that rail enhancement fund. In addition, in 2007, in the well-known House Bill 3202, there's also a provision for some of the capital projects revenue bonds earmarked for rail. That's that 4.3%. Under the Rail Enhancement Fund, there has got to be demonstrated by the applying railroad a, quote, public benefits test that is met. And if that test is met, the CTB approves it, then it does require 30% match to the state fund. So it's a 70% state, 30% match from the rail. The second fund, the one of most interest to the short lines, provides assistance to them. The program dates back to 1991, including the match from the railroads is $20 million in your six-year improvement program for rail upgrade projects. And as I stated, this is a great tool for economic development and a way to preserve our tracks in Virginia, because you know, once you take the tracks up, you're not going to get them back in place. And so actually part of your public benefits is simply preserving the track for, if not a present, then a future economic prospect. These are some examples of use of the Rail Preservation Fund. One in Central Virginia and Buckingham Branch and Dawsville up in, I think, Hanover County, and then how the Bay Coast Railroad has benefited, as well as the role the short lines have played in the APM Maersk terminal decision to build that terminal in Virginia, and the Commonwealth Rail, one of the short lines, had a role in making that, making the connection between the port and the Class 1s. Third fund is the Rail Industrial Access Fund. That goes back a bit. That is frequently that last mile to a new industry. It keeps those jobs coming into some of those more rural areas, and it gets trucks off the roads. It can be an important incentive in the governor's package to attract and retain business and industry. And there is, a public benefits test of sorts. There are clawback provisions where the private railroad or the private industry would have to return the money that was used for the track if, in fact, that industrial prospect turns out that they're not going to use the rail line or the spur. Our concerns about these programs, there is strong competition for the rail enhancement money. The annual appropriation for the Rail Preservation Fund has remained constant at that for a number of years, that $3 million, even though the actual trackage has doubled in that period. And this third point is one that we would particularly like to emphasize, and that is with the establishment of the new Intercity Passenger Rail Operating and Capital Fund, there is no funding source for passenger rail. And as Kevin Page has spoken to you all about previously, as the federal government turns over more of the operations of regional trains and Amtrak system to states, the Commonwealth is going to have to pick up that tab for those, I think, six regional trains. What the General Assembly has done the last 2 years has been to take money out of the Rail Enhancement Fund that requires that 70-30 match and put it into this passenger rail fund as a subsidy to replace the funds that have been lost from the federal government's backing off and supporting those and those regional Amtrak trains. Some of our concerns about the future, the heavier rail cars, how they threaten the short-term, the viability of the short lines, that more money is needed in the future to keep up the maintenance and construction of these programs so the short lines can continue to play a role, with the alternative being heavy trucks on our highways, and our concern that the General Assembly has not identified and passed legislation that would establish that separate funding source for the short lines. We do think that the short lines future is exciting. Governor Granholm has made a big emphasis on job creation and economic development. He's paid particular attention in our more rural areas. Short lines want to continue to be a player in the overall transportation network. And in order for the short lines that do have these capital-intensive projects, it is important that we, and I hope that you would agree, that we continue to maintain the partnership between the state through these rail funds and the short line railroads. With that, I will be glad to answer any questions. We'll also have with us, as I said, Mr. Gail Wilson, as well as your resident expert, Kevin Page, Delma Drake. So, thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Ms. Clement, thank you very much. Are any questions? Yes, Mr. Peek.
Mr. Clement, thank you for the presentation. Good to see you. Appreciate the work you do on behalf of railroads. All right, this is a more simple, practical question. I don't believe that a rail line of rail cars goes 480 miles on 1 gallon of diesel fuel.
Hard to believe.
I don't believe it. So you tell me my Amtrak train from Lynchburg can go to Washington, D.C. on 1 gallon of diesel fuel?
No, it's based on that tonnage.
Yeah. So explain that.
Where's Kevin Page when we need him? I've actually looked that up and tried to revalidate it, and I think that is true, and that's one reason I put the bullet in there on the Transportation Research Council, because that is recent data from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may help out our colleague here. Railroads typically follow rivers and streams. For example, from Eagle Rock, Virginia to Richmond is prevailing downgrade through Lynchburg. That locomotive is actually put into idle at Eagle Rock and basically coasts to Richmond with an entire high tonnage train. So using gravity and roller bearings, once you get the tonnage moving, you can have, you know, thousands of tons of freight moving at absolutely limited fuel consumption. That's the beauty of the inertia that's created by the movement of the train and gravity.
That's what
Oliver
said.
All right.
You know,
back to the mine uses less.
It's sort of like the bateau's going downstream.
Right.
It's coming back. That's the hard part.
It's got to go uphill at some point. It's not always downhill.
Well, then you get a run for the hill, so to speak.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What as CTB do we do? Funds, are you concerned about the way we're distributing them, how you want us to distribute them? What is the message?
Our message to members of the Transportation Board is simply that you know about these funds. They'll come before the six-year improvement program comes before you in the spring in a draft form. There are provisions in that six-year plan. I know that you're more focused on the highway section because that consumes 95% of all those pages in the six-year plan. But at the back, it lays out exactly who the beneficiaries are, what railroads you're partnering with, and what those projects are, and you approve. And or you can disapprove. Or if there is a compelling case, you have the option to look at even other funds to supplement what you might want to do for rail if it serves the public benefit.
Yes, Ms. Lane.
Good to see you. What impact does the federal rail policy, do you see any impact or concerns in regards to short line railroads?
There are efforts from time to time by the National Association of Short Lines to lobby Congress. I know there have been, I think, and I know that Kevin knows this, and Gail Wilson, for example, on tax credits, investments, creating incentives from the private sector to invest, because it is very capital intensive. The other way that there has been a very direct impact is through the action by Congress on Amtrak. It's putting more pressure on states, not putting as much pressure on the CTB as it does on the General Assembly. And if the General Assembly continues to take money out of the Rail Enhancement Fund that statutorily is intended for freight rail, meeting a public benefits test with a 70-30 match, if you keep taking that and putting it into this new passenger rail fund, as is the case for the next 2 years, and it's reflected in your six-year program, you are essentially taking money out of capital for future investments. And it's, Delma, I don't think we're different too much with that. It's a short-term solution, but it's not a long-term proposition that I think Virginia should pursue, because we have made, I think Kevin presented earlier this week, something like $600 million in freight rate and track infrastructure in the last 10 years. Is that right, Kevin? With the public, with the private match. That's a huge amount of money to go on our rail that we lose sight of because of all of our concerns about our highways and maintenance and construction. So that is a huge impact upon the rail program in Virginia as a result of the action of Congress.
Thank you. Mr. Lauterbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question. We talk about funding, and I know funding is tight in all areas now. If we were able to, let's just say right now, how much of your effort has been delayed, or how much extra capacity could we get if we had additional funding for rail right now? Are there any projects that are not able to go forward, or are there existing?
No, I think right now, Thelma Drake has been very transparent in working with the railroads. She reached out, I know, to Norfolk Southern in being able to divert some of the Rail Enhancement Fund to delay a project of theirs, and Norfolk Southern was okay with that. And so that did not create a hardship by moving some of the Rail Enhancement Fund into the new passenger rail fund. But that's not to say that you couldn't have some great opportunities in the future that you would be deprived of without money that could have been in the Rail Enhancement Fund, or for that matter, the Preservation Fund.
One quick follow-up. On that, I was just kind of wondering, if we talk about how many trucks could be diverted off the highways, 81 and others, do we have anything identified right now as to potential capacity that we're not fulfilling, that we could possibly take more trucks off the road?
Kevin can speak much better to that, but I do know that the Crescent Corridor, where there have been millions of dollars invested under the partnership with the state in Norfolk Southern, has been able to demonstrate a diversion of heavy trucks off of 81, using mainly the Route 29 corridor. And then when it gets up to around Manassas, you know, then heads west, north of Luray, and then ties into up at 81. Kevin, I can give you some more data on that.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Clement. Can you give us a quick flavor of what the trend line, what the economic trend lines have been over the last decade of the short lines in Virginia in terms of jobs, revenue levels, et cetera?
I cannot. There are different short lines do better than other short lines. Gail Wilson with Buckingham Branch, they acquired, Gail, why don't you come up and mention the, they acquired the Virginia Carolina Railroad. They've had problems with getting coal into Mecklenburg County because of the less consumption of coal. And so that trend line is bad, but they stepped in to take it over. On the other hand, there have been examples where industry is coming to Virginia, and the governor's office or the Virginia Economic Development Partnership would get the short lines involved to help put it together. So I think they have their ups and downs. There are success stories, and then there are stories where things don't work out. There was a beer distributorship that was coming to Virginia. Buckingham Branch was involved in it. They then relocated another state. So that did not pan out. Any other examples?
Yeah, just an example, sir, of our company. 8 years ago, we were the smallest short line. We only operated about 17 miles and had about a half a dozen employees. Since that time period, we have took over 200 miles of property that CSX owns. We leased that runs from Richmond, Virginia to Clifton Forge. And we also took over another short line in the Clarksville, Keysville, Burkeville area that Norfolk Southern owns and we leased. So that took us from about less than 8 employees 8 years ago to about 90 now. And we went from 17 miles to 300 miles operation. Now, that is not typical of all the short lines in Virginia. That's just an example of how we operate. And our goal is simple. We are the guys that do the work for the last mile and sometimes the first mile. All the short lines in Virginia, I will add just as a quick history, our existence came about due to properties that the Class 1s owns that they could not operate profitable. So they had the alternative of either leasing, abandon, or selling the property. So those properties came out, and entrepreneurs such as us, my company's privately held, we lease or buy those railroads, and then with the help of the State Department of Rail and the CTB, through the funds that Whit talked about, we try to preserve those tracks. And most of the short lines operate in Virginia in very rural counties too, you know, such as Lunenburg, Bath County, and areas like that. That's pretty vital to industry in those areas.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, Ms. Garzanis. Secretary Clement, we've throughout your presentation is reference to the General Assembly, and since the CTB can't perform the loaves and fishes miracle, are you going to be sharing a legislative strategy with our team as the Assembly approaches for the new year on what you're going to be asking for, what you're going to be lobbying for at the General Assembly? And could you, will you share that with us?
Will I share it with you? Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm glad to. We stay in touch with the Secretary and Thelma Drake. You know, I know that DRPT is concerned not having an identified funding source for the new passenger rail fund. That's probably our number one priority. Mm-hmm. We can't keep kicking that can down the track, but we are for the time being. That's
Thank
the main
you.
One.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Secretary, yes, Craig. And welcome. Clement, it's good to see you, and thank you for coming up to do that presentation, because I think it's something most of our members haven't heard. But I also want to point out that the investments that are put into passenger rail, since we commingle with freight, they do have a benefit to the freight line. They typically are CSX and Norfolk Southern, because that's where our passenger lines run. So the work that's done on those for, say, the service into Norfolk is also going to benefit freight movement out of the port on Norfolk Southern Line, because they'll also use our improvements. The problem for short lines is we don't typically run passenger on the short lines, with the exception of the Buckingham Branch, which is an Amtrak long-distance train that runs through there. So to the question about the federal government, if they would come in and improve Buckingham Branch so that Amtrak, the Cardinal, runs better, that would be a huge improvement, but that's part of what Gail is dealing with, is he's got to deal with the passenger train without the funds to do the improvements that he needs so it commingles well. So I just wanted you to know there's a dual benefit to the passenger, but typically not for the short line.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Ms. Clement, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming up here. We have a presentation by the Virginia Association of Metropolitan Planning Organizations, Mr. Crum and Mr. Farmer.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, Director Drake, Commonwealth Transportation Board members. My name is Bob Crum. I'm with the Richmond Regional Planning District Commission as the Executive Director of the Commission. Also a board member of the Richmond Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. And today I'm here in the position of Chair of the Virginia Association of Metropolitan Planning Organizations. Very pleased to be with you today, that we can take a few minutes today to introduce you to VAMPO, an organization that's just beginning its third year, and give you a little bit of information about our organization, some of our work, and how we want to be a working partner with you on transportation planning and programming within the Commonwealth of Virginia. Just before we get started today, I'm just going to ask if everyone in the audience is either a MPO staff member or board member, if you could please stand. Just want to give everybody a quick idea. We have representation from most of our MPOs today. Thank you very much. And you'll be hearing through our presentation from representatives of the various MPOs. With two exceptions, our two local MPOs, of course, will be doing feature presentations today, so we're not going to steal their thunder and let them touch on the points that they want to raise during their presentations, which will follow ours. So just to start, a little bit of information about what is VAMPO. VAMPO is an association of MPOs within Virginia. We're very pleased that we have 100% membership from all of our MPOs in our organization. We really grew out of the General Assembly, the House of Delegates, a joint resolution calling for MPOs in Virginia to come together in a professional organization. And what we're doing is exchanging information and experiences on best management practices. I think many of you know that transportation planning and programming can be a complicated matter. We find great benefit of getting together and understanding best management practices among our various MPO staffs, sharing good information on what's working with metropolitan transportation planning, providing education opportunities for our staff, but really where we want to evolve is we want to be in a good position to speak as a voice for all the MPOs, all the urbanized areas within Virginia, to provide recommendations to you as the CTB and to provide recommendations to the Secretary of Transportation on ways that we can continue to work with you to improve transportation planning and programming in our Commonwealth. And we think this next slide shows a little bit of information on the importance of coordinating with MPOs. Again, remembering that MPOs are the federally designated transportation planning and programming organizations for urbanized areas within the Commonwealth of Virginia. We have 14 designated urbanized areas, and I think these statistics speak for themselves. Our MPOs contain 81% of the population within Virginia. We contain 85% of Virginia's employment and about 89% of the gross product. So clearly investment in urbanizing areas is not only consistent with smart planning, but also consistent and very helpful with promoting the strong economy that we all strive for here within Virginia. So with that brief introduction, what we'd like to do is we want to start with giving you a quick Google Earth tour of the various MPOs areas within Virginia. Just touching on some of the major transportation facilities within each MPO area. And then when we do that, we're going to ask each MPO to come up and spend about 60 seconds with you touching on a transportation project, opportunity, or challenge within their geographic area. So I'm going to refer to Dwight Farmer, who's the vice chair of VAMPO, and he's going to walk us through our state tour real quick.
Good morning. I'm going to, as Bob said, I'm going to take you on a tour. It's a 4-minute video slide, so if you ask me to pause, you're going to challenge me technically. So once the thing starts, it's going to be a fast ride again, 4 minutes. But I had Carol, asked Carol if she could hand out at your place a hard copy, and it has hard copies of all the screenshots. So as you see things come and go, and you may want to have taken your Dramamine as you're watching this thing, as you see things come and go, there are screenshots in hard copy form at your seat, and I've also got a box of additional copies for anyone else. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and start this, and I'm going to try to stay with this so you'll know exactly where we are and what's going on. And I hit the button, and nothing happens.
Are we challenging you already?
They challenged me already. I thought this thing would... Somebody... It should start on the video. Laid plans of mine. Well, so much for the video. I guess we'll go to the slides. And, let me advance myself to the individual ones here. I'm gonna cover just for a brief moment here for Blacksburg and Christiansburg. What Blacksburg, Christiansburg, Montgomery County MPO has indicated as one of their top priorities is completing the interstate or doing the Interstate 81 improvements here at Christiansburg. So I understand, again, that's at the top of their list. Bob, we're going to probably go ahead and some folks up.
Gary Christie from Central Virginia. We serve Lynchburg and the urbanized areas of Bedford, Campbell, and Amherst County.
Do we keep on the next slide?
The point I wanted to make was Liberty University. Liberty University is going to be growing ever since 2010. They're at 12,500 students now. They're going to hit 15,000 students in residence by 2020. They've got a new school of nursing and a health sciences school going up. They've got ball fields. They've got parking. They've got new dormitories going. And it continues to put pressure on our community. We appreciate what's been done or planned for the Odd Fellows Road interchange. And that continues to put additional pressure on our MPO to respond to the growth of Liberty, which is positive for our community because it's a strong economic development engine. So thank you. I'll leave that with you and turn it over to the next one.
Okay, I'm going to ask Aaron Burdick to come on up from the West Piedmont PDC. Aaron's battling a case of laryngitis, so I'm going to do it. Can you go ahead and do it?
All right. Thank you for this opportunity. My major transportation priority project for the Danville MPO relates to a designation that this board made by transferring Route 863 Berry Hill Road from the state secondary system to the primary highway system over the summer. This is a stretch of about 7.5 miles extending from the North Carolina line up to Route 58. And the major impacts of this relate to the 3,500-acre Berry Hill Mega Park, which our region feels is the biggest draw to the economic development growth of our region, one of the most highly distressed in the state. This transformation also improves connectivity between Danville and Eden and now makes the route eligible for more state and federal funding. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. How much is the project? Have we done any sort of assessment?
We do not currently have any plans or funding associated with this as far as we are aware of at this time.
And I'm sorry, I just want to ask you, what's the topography there? I mean, it's only 7.5 miles?
Yes, sir.
And is it difficult terrain or no?
Yes, sir. There are some minor geometric issues with the current secondary road running through there, but the topography is relatively simple to maneuver through.
And do you have sewer and water and the utilities already into that mega park?
Water and sewer are readily available.
But you already have sewer and water there?
Yes, sir, and then all the agreements are in place for how the park will be serviced.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. I'm Lloyd Robinson. I'm the administrator for the Fredericksburg, Virginia MPO. Thank you. Just before I do this, I want to thank the Commonwealth for the partnership that we have as an MPO and that BAMPO has with you all. In my opinion, it's working. It's working pretty well. Our number one priority in the Fredericksburg area is interchange reconstruction at exit 140, the so-called Courthouse Road, Route 630 interchange. It's in design right now, and we need you to send money for construction. We're about $140 million short. So I'll do that again. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lloyd. Good seeing you.
I'm just going to take you through just some of our highest priority project here in Hampton Roads. As most of you are now probably familiar with, we have a critical need for improvements for what we call a Hampton Roads crossing. And the Commonwealth is currently engaged in completing a new environmental document to reevaluate this crossing in the green line at Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, HRBT, during a typical month of the typical day. During a typical month, we're carrying 90 to 95,000 cars a day. In the summer, I think the peak has been something in the order of 108,000 cars per day on a four-lane facility. You also see in the gold and yellow color here what's known as a Patriot Crossing. It does a couple things. It makes a connection between the south portal of the Monitor Merrimack Memorial Bridge Tunnel, which is I-664, and it takes you east over to the Norfolk International Terminals and further east into a connection with Interstate 564, which connects with the Naval Station in Norfolk. And in the middle of that east-west connector, you'll see what I often refer to as a Craney Island connector. It'll take you off the east face of the Craney Island expansion project where a fourth marine terminal is being prepared. So a very critical step for us once the department's environmental work, and Greg, I'm not sure exactly what month that project, that environmental document will be done, but I understand this coming year that work will be complete, and then the Hampton Roads TPO, the MPO in Hampton Roads, will have to make a decision on its priority for doing that crossing. Both of those, I think the latest information, Greg, from your folks is, with updated information, the Patriot Crossing is in the order of $3.5 billion, and we've seen numbers that range from $2.5 to $4 or $5 billion on their HRBT, depending on whether you're in the air or underwater. So nine zeros, a lot of money. They're talking tolls. First toll proposal here was $4 to $6 one way from a private proposal, unsolicited. So a very important decision is coming up for us, and we'll probably need some help with buying down that toll.
Okay, in Harrisonburg, Rockingham, you'll hear from a little later this morning. Richmond area MPO, which I will represent today, the project we want to discuss related to the Richmond area MPO is the Port of Richmond. Several years ago, our MPO took regional transportation money and used it to fund a barge service that runs from the port of Hampton Roads up to the port in the city of Richmond. And this project has been very successful. It reached a major milestone about 14 months ago when the Virginia Port Authority took over the management and operations of the Port of Richmond through a lease with the City of Richmond. We've seen a significant increase in the amount of freight arriving at our port. We are really beginning to bring together a lot of energy from not only the City of Richmond, but our surrounding counties, and trying to take advantage of the tremendous economic development opportunities that the future success of the port can offer to our region. And we really are excited to continue to work with the CTB and VDOT and DRPT and others to improve the transportation network within our region to provide strong connections to the Port of Richmond. This is an effort that we're really excited about. I think it's been a great example of state and MPO partnership effort to sort of celebrate the success. Jeff Kiever from the Virginia Port Authority is going to meet our MPO at the Port of Richmond on October the 1st when our region and our MPO board is going to receive an update on the progress on this initiative. So certainly compliment BPA and all their work to breathe some life into our port, which we think is going to pay significant benefits for the metropolitan Richmond area. Next up is Roanoke Valley. Wayne.
Good morning. I'm Richard Floor, Chairman of the Roanoke Area MPO and also Chairman of the Roanoke County Board of Supervisors. Delighted to be here today with you, and thank you for this opportunity. We have multiple challenges, just like everyone else, but we'll talk about two of them. The first one is the transitioning from the traditional MPO to a TMA, a Transportation Management Area, as a result of course, our increased population in the urbanized area, and the additional challenge of taking in an additional jurisdiction, which is Montgomery County, which will be adding to our MPO as a representative. This brings with it opportunities and challenges, the challenge being that we're going to have more regs to learn to comply with, the opportunities we're going to be able to do more things, so it's a double-edged sword. The second one is on the screen. This is the corridor that traverses, it's Route 419, traverses through Roanoke City, Roanoke County, and the City of Salem. Extends about 9.5 miles and is mostly a four-lane divided highway. The problem is that the traffic and the congestion there has already become significant. VDOT and the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission joined in a study and did a detailed analysis of this corridor and has recently submitted a report. Indicates that by 2018, 50% of the intersections, signalized intersections on this corridor will be operating at an E or F level of service, which is the lowest level of service VDOT recognizes. In addition, by 2035, 75% of those intersections will be operating at the E or F. So it's probably the most challenging corridor that we have in the Roanoke Valley and is already suggesting to us that we need to take a look at it. The backup around on 419 at 220 in the afternoon and morning extends upwards of 2 or 3 miles. So it's pretty significant. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here. We thank you for the for your attention.
In Tri-Cities MPO.
Morning, members of the panel. My name is Joseph Vinch. I'm employed by the Crater Planning District, and I serve as the Secretary to the Tri-Cities MPO. Our project this morning to feature is the I-95, I-85, Route 460 interchange located in Petersburg. At this time, the Richmond District of VDOT is completing a roadside safety assessment of this location. This facility was constructed in 1958, and it's one of the oldest interstate facilities in the Commonwealth. There are several safety and design improvement needs at this location. The study divided the improvements into short-term concepts and long-term concepts. Problems were identified, a range of alternatives were considered, and a recommended solution was made. For the short-term solution, a total of $700,000 is going to be required to include a crash barrier on for Wagner Road and some improvements to the Washington Street exit southbound on 95. Longer-term concepts were more involved. They involve a weaving merge I-85 northbound to I-95 southbound at Graham Road, the weave problem of South Crater Road to I-95 northbound, and a tight turn and low bridge clearance at I-95 northbound to I-85 southbound movement. The solutions for all these long-term concepts came to a total of $55,700,000. And the total with the short-term and long-term improvements were $71 million. So now that's the outcome. Right now, the city of Petersburg is reviewing these options, and they will probably be coming to the MPO for consideration in our long-range plan to modify what we have now for interstate improvements. Questions?
Mr. Worley, if I remember correctly, in our 95 toll proposal, all those projects were going to be funded in there. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
Did you all take a position on the 95 toll?
The central office at VDOT does provide us a financial forecast for our 2035 plan, total $96 million. The MPO membership identified candidate interstate projects and rated those projects. This interchange, I-85, 95, 460, is top-rated project. That's listed number one in our long-range plan.
We're trying to fund it for you.
You already told us there's funding.
Yeah. Well, we're going to try to fund even more.
We have no toll money shown in our long-range plan for this project.
Excellent. Well, we can do a lot of things with that toll money.
Well, we have $96 million now.
I know. Well,
by the year 2035.
So since we already have that money, I can move the toll money on other projects?
I don't know. We'd have to take that to the group.
All right.
Thank you.
Give you our time. Thank you. Okay, well, thank you. We wanted to provide you that overview today just so you could get a flavor from some of the MPOs of what the major issues and challenges are. Mr. Secretary, if I may, we are under the understanding that our technical glitch is solved. With Dwight being forever resilient, we'd like to try to see if we can get this fired back up and do a quick run-through for you of that presentation.
There's not going to be any sound, so I'm going to be your only sound here. And again, you have screenshots. So this thing is going to wind up and showing you, as we zoom in, where the meeting is today. Again, this is going to go fast and furious here. This is going to be 81, 17, and 50. And the inland port. Again, you have screenshots of all this at your seat. Fredericksburg, we have the VRE. Station. I-95 in Fredericksburg. And I'm always amazed, Lloyd, at all the developments going on in and around Fredericksburg. This is coming up is the port of Richmond. This is going to be 64 and 295. 64 and I-95 and the Main Street Station in Richmond, downtown. And our favorite rail place, Thelma, Acca Yard. Staples Mill Station. Next, you're going to see the high-rise bridge on I-64 and the southern branch of the Elizabeth River. And then the ATM terminal, looking kind of northeast. And then the Midtown Tunnel, which is underway. Thank you very much. And the Harbor Park, where the Amtrak and light rail station is. And this is the naval station in Norfolk. It's I-64 in the peninsula at Bland Boulevard. This is 295, this label, this label is 295 and 460. No, that's correct. Sorry, your screenshot's wrong. I-85 and 95. We have Route 58 business and 58 in Danville. And then 29. Bristol Motor Speedway is coming up. So be careful what you do there. We have you on satellite video. And then I-81 and 381. And my alma mater, Virginia Tech, is coming up. And I-81 and Route 8. Downtown Norfolk coming up. Wayne. And you'll see the Norfolk Southern Rail Yard coming up. And I-81 and I-581. Huge line of trucks coming up last night, as you all know, on I-81. Liberty University coming up in Lynchburg. In the Route 29 corridor, still in Lynchburg. And the B&W nuclear plant. And UVA, our arch rivals, and a great place, by the way, used to live there. 64 and 29. Route 29 and 250 is coming up. James Madison University. Route 33 is coming up. And the I-81 corridor. And that should be it. Again, each of you have a screenshot and hard copy of all this in case you want to keep a reference for that.
That concludes our presentation. I just want to thank the board today for taking the time to hear from VAMPO. And we'll just leave you with the item that we want to stress is that is Virginia's MPOs, we're organized. We have an association to pull together key leaders from our MPOs. If the CTV or the administration ever needs a reaction to ideas, proposals, thoughts about future areas in terms of directions to move forward. We just want you to know that we can mobilize fairly quickly. We can gauge perspectives on different issues among all our MPOs in the state. And we want to be here to be a working partner with you and help you with your work. So with that, we'll be happy to respond to any questions, but I very much thank you for your time today.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Hey. I'll ask the indulgence for a point of personal privilege to say that Wayne Strickland in the Roanoke area has been exemplary in taking the initiative on those four initiatives that VAMPO is supposed to do. And while I have no doubt that that might be true for other areas, I know it's true for Wayne. I want to commend him for that.
Mr. Chairman. More to a comment than a question. As I look at the map that was provided in the beginning of the presentation that shows where the different MPOs were located, and I go to the slide that talks about the population that they contain versus the rest of the state, et cetera, et cetera, it highlights and emphasizes the point that I'm going to make, and it goes to a point that we've sort of talked about a little bit here today and that Mr. Farmer has spoken about. If you look at the map and you look at the red areas on it, and I'm just sort of doing it by guess, it looks like it's maybe 15% or 20% of the land in the state is represented by MPOs, and I'm guessing at that, but I think it's probably pretty close. And yet they represent 81% of the population, 85% of the employment, and 89% of the gross product of the state. And Mr. Farmer said when he looked at the, when he showed us the couple crossings in Hampton Roads, and this is not unique to Hampton Roads, but it's unique to that whole Golden Crescent that goes from Hampton Roads to Richmond to Northern Virginia. He said that tolls would be required. And I don't subscribe to that. Tolls are not required. Tolls are only required if that's how we decide to do it. The real problem here is that you've got a huge economic engine between Hampton Roads and the Northern Virginia district. I don't know what percent of that GDP comes out of there, but I would suggest to you it's a pretty high percent of that 89. And yet, because of our, so all that benefit flows to the rest of the state. But because we have lots of people and lots of congestion and lots of issues, particularly in Hampton Roads with water, we find ourselves with expensive projects. And I believe our governor and our secretary and others have done everything that they can do. They've even advocated for some increased taxes, but the legislature has not done what it should do. And so when you take a piece of the state that's generating a huge piece of GDP and you say, folks, we're going to make you pay for your own rolls by tolls, the rest of us are going to just do our own thing, that's inequitable, it's wrong, it's inefficient. It's not the way to pay for roads in Virginia. And it's just not right. It's not a good economic model. It costs more to do tolling than it does to do sales taxes or gas taxes, and there's all sorts of issues. So I would hate for our group, and I know there's some of us here who think we ought to be, as CDB members, we have a role to play in being more vocal with our legislators and other policymakers as to how roads and rail and other things should be funded in our state. And I intend to continue to be vocal about it, and I discard the view that tolls are necessary. I realize Mr. Farmer is saying that in a practical sense because the legislature has not deemed to do it otherwise, but it's inequitable, it's unfair, it's wrong, it's not the right way to do it. And I wouldn't say there's no role for tolls whatsoever, ever. But we're heading down that road way too much, in my opinion, and it's not the right way to go. So that's my message to my colleagues and to those here today, and that I'll be silent here.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Mr. I'd like to follow up on that a little bit. I was talking with John a little bit earlier. John, you correct me if I misstate any of this, but we were talking about in FY 2012, the expenditures were $4.1 billion. But if you count not just the debt service, but the principal of the debt, it's about $3 billion out of all of that. So you can see this kind of follows up on your tolls. There's only so much we can do with debt.
We've done it.
And tolls, yeah, we're about done. So I think that's a figure to keep in mind of how much we're in debt.
And Mr. Chairman, one last point. For me, and I don't care where I go in this state, if I pay $4.50 or $6 or $1.50, I don't care what it is, it doesn't matter to me whether you take that and put it in a fast toll box or in a collection machine or in a sales tax or in a gas tax. It's $4.50. So we play this game in the political arena that say, well, no taxes, but give me $4.50. As if there's some real difference, and it's just not. It makes no sense.
Any other questions? Mr. Crum, actually, I obviously a big glaring hole is the lack of involvement of the Washington MPO. Can you just make a comment about that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Secretary.
It's about the lack of the involvement of the Washington MPO in your efforts. Can you?
We will be reaching north to our colleagues at WashCog. What the Secretary Connaughton is referring to is Northern Virginia is actually part of the Washington Council of Governments for their Metropolitan Planning Organization work. And we see it as critical to be able to reach out to them and involve them in our Virginia MPO deliberations, and we'll be following up on that.
Do you think your organization would ever get behind potentially creating a sub-MPO for Northern Virginia only?
We've had some preliminary discussions on that matter with our peer PDC, the Northern Virginia Regional Commission, and others in Northern Virginia. I'll speak for myself, I think that would be a positive move. I can't speak for VAMPO and that we have not voted on that as a board yet, but that's certainly something our organization would be willing to work with Northern Virginia on, absolutely. And any help we could provide.
I don't know if this number is still correct, but it's sort of interesting, was 80% of the transportation construction projects going on in the entire Washington region are going on in Northern Virginia. And to have essentially an organization that is very focused on the inner core, which is very positive, but the thing is that most of the work on transportation in the Washington region are really, it's occurring in Northern Virginia. And we're putting the investment in, and we should end up having much more involvement in, you know, by our localities in where we're putting that money.
Well, I certainly can make that a priority to do that outreach and see what conversations we can have.
Particularly because of the amount of money. I mean, the other challenge we have is that, I forget what the TPB's annual budget is, but I think it's $100 million. Or something like that? I mean, so we are funding, I believe it's $100 million. I could be wrong on the number, but it's very sizable. That's going into the whole Washington region. And again, it's not focused on where most of the projects are occurring. So any assistance you all could give us as an organization to get Northern Virginia involved with your group is very, very important.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Right.
We'll now get a couple presentations on MPOs that are immediately in this area. And the first is from Martha Schickel, who's from the Winchester Frederick MPO.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, it's great to be here today and great to have you all in Winchester, in the Northern Shenandoah Valley and in the Stanton District. I will let you know that the presentation on this large screen does deviate slightly from what's on your monitors, and I'll let you know when that happens. Just a little bit of background for you about the Winchester Frederick MPO. We were established in 2002, so we are a relatively new organization. And our MPO area includes the city of Winchester, the urbanized areas of Frederick County, and the town of Stephen City. Our organizational structure includes three committees, similar to many other MPOs. We have a policy board, which is our governing body, a technical advisory committee, and a citizens advisory committee. And we also utilize a number of different groups to maneuver projects depending on the scope of those. The MPO is administered by the Northern Shenandoah Valley Regional Commission. The map here shows you the MPO area. The green area is actually the area defined by the 2000 census. We are the northernmost point in Virginia. And the area outlined in the blue areas is the new area as defined by the 2010 census. Just to give you an idea of the size of our area population-wise, and our anticipated growth. We've seen tremendous growth in our MPO area, and we intend to continue to see that growth. The Winchester-Frederick MPO area is the business hub of the Northern Shenandoah Valley. Listed some major employers there for you to get a feel for the range of different industries that we have here that, of course, all depend on our transportation networks. This slide just gives you an idea of the different types of roadways in our MPO area. So one of the major initiatives with the Winchester-Frederick MPO this past year has been the update to the long-range transportation plan. So that plan now goes to through 2035. It is, of course, the principal planning responsibility for our MPO, and it identifies the key projects that are priorities for our region. When we look at the long-range transportation plan, it includes a listing of projects desired for the area. That's our vision list. It has, I think, over 200 project priorities right now, and our constrained long-range transportation plan, which is, of course, constrained by the financial projections for the period, includes a much smaller list, and that's what I'll say is our reality check. So priority project types include long-range planning, modeling GIS data evaluation, access management safety corridor planning, pedestrian and bicycle planning, public mobility programs, and local technical assistance. I know that many of you attended a tour through the community yesterday, so in respect of your time, I'm going to quickly brush through a couple of initiatives that the MPO has, which hopefully will echo what you saw yesterday in the community. With bicycle and pedestrian planning, the MPO is currently engaged in a project that was kicked off last fiscal year. It is a bike and pedestrian facilities assessment. We're in the process of engaging the public and giving us their input on the condition of those bike and pedestrian facilities in the region. And we've got a really exciting interactive map that members of the public can access via the web. To identify geographic points and answer comments about those areas. So we're able to learn particular problem intersections, issues with sidewalk conditions, where there may not be a bike facility where traffic might exist. In the area of public mobility, we're excited to have released, in coordination with the WinTran program, a ride guide that was completed just this summer. And it's a resource for riders that really integrated the use of GIS and mapping with graphic design. So I apologize that it's a little fuzzy, but the left side of the screen, and I think if you skipped ahead a couple of slides, did I lose everyone? If you see the left side, that's the cover of the guide, and then the right side is just a snapshot of one of the maps inside the guide. Each of the routes for the WinTran system are color-coded, and the guide provides schedules and information about how to access the transit system. That'll also be translated into Spanish and provided in English as well. I know you're familiar with our interstate priorities, exits 307, 310, and 313, those interchanges. I think you saw those yesterday on your tour, but I just would like to echo that we appreciate the support from the state with regard to those improvements, and we look forward to continuing to work with you on those. Of course, I think you also took a tour of the Route 277 corridor with that study and the related assessment of the bridge at exit 307. The Route 37 extension, our priority focus there is the section between Interstate 81 and 37 on the south side of the city of Winchester, extending through to Route 522. I know that you also were able to visit the Hope Drive extension and Tevis Street extension, extending over Interstate 81, connecting to US 522. This is a tremendous opportunity, I think, for the local community as well as for the Commonwealth to be able to identify an alternative route during the bridge improvements just north of that proposed crossover. Again, that was a brief overview of many of the projects that you visited yesterday. In respect for time, I thought you might appreciate moving on to the rest of your agenda. But I'm happy to answer any questions We appreciate you being here, and we look forward to working with the CTV and our new district representative in the future.
Great. Any questions? Yes, Mr. Lloyd.
Has your organization, have you researched this, and I'm ignorant on this, the Millwood Road situation and the potential, or have you guys looked at that and taken a position?
The Winchester-Frederick MPO did engage study services, and I will defer also to our TAC committee chairman because that was before my time involved with the MPO. Whether the MPO has reviewed the proposed development.
The original study, the technical study, continuing plant pressure in the city, the original study on Millwood Avenue was commissioned through the MPO. Former director, as the chair indicated, and that led to a decision by the policy board to forward it to the city council for action, and it was then decided that there needed to be follow-up study, which was subsequently done, working with the city and the university.
So that their recommendation is consistent with your study?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Secretary.
Yes,
we did appreciate the tour, and there are many worthwhile projects that we saw. Has the MPO prioritized those in rank order, though, of the ones that we saw yesterday?
Within the constrained list, we've prioritized them within the type of roadway. So we have our primary, our secondary roadway projects, and so they're prioritized in that regard. And I could certainly provide that information to you that within each of those categories.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
The Harrisburg-Rockingham MPO?
Good morning. I'm Carol Shepherd. I'm here from the Harrisonburg-Rockingham County MPO, and I'm here. I'm the chair of the MPO there, and I'm here today with Bonnie Ridesell and Kevin McDermott from the Central Shenandoah Planning District Commission. It's a pleasure to be here to tell you a little bit about our MPO. We are in the heart of the Shenandoah Valley. You can see on the map there in the west central region. We cover the city of Harrisonburg, the county of Rockingham, and the towns of Dayton, Bridgewater, and Mount Crawford. And you can see the region there, and that is Route 81 that comes right down through the center of our region. Our area, it has a population of 74,000, and the bulk of that is in Harrisonburg. And since 2000, we are the third highest growth rate in the state of Virginia behind Northern Virginia and Winchester. And that is probably our significant statistic. While our population is relatively small, the rapid rate of our growth has us outsizing our infrastructure really rapidly. A little bit about our economic climate. We are the number one county in Virginia for agricultural sales, and the entire region is actually contains 25% of the state's agricultural revenue. What that means is that we have some interesting challenges in terms of the types of vehicles that need to use our roadways, the types of vehicles that are transporting merchandise. We are one of four metro areas with job growth, and you see there a picture of the new Rockingham Memorial Hospital, which is one of our primary employers and the center of our health care. We have some large bioscience industries with SRI and Merck, and some large technology centers with the Blue Ridge Data Center and Rosetta Stone. You see some of the school systems noted there. Education is a big growth industry in our area and also a major user of transportation and poser of transportation challenges. James Madison University is the largest university. You can see 2011, the 19,000 students there. They are poised to move well beyond that, over 20,000 in the near future. Bridgewater Colleges have also seen a lot of growth, as has Eastern Mennonite University, all contributing to higher ed growth in the region. The local school system covers 12 elementary schools, 4 middle schools, and 4 high schools, and a number of other institutions mentioned there. And you'll see shortly that Safe Rides to School is one of our important initiatives. Our transportation network covers a lot of different sorts of venues. You have the roadways, some historic scenic routes and public transportation, all of them serving the growth in the area. We have some unique challenges. We have aviation travel through the Shenandoah Valley Regional Airport and the smaller Bridgewater Air Park that has been growing. And rail, as has been mentioned earlier, but we also have alternative transportation challenges in terms of bicycle paths, but also a pretty large old order population, which gives us a lot of horse and buggy paths, horse and buggy transportation. So sharing the road becomes a big challenge in our area. More and more vehicles are sharing the roadways there, one of the ways that we've focused on that is with the bicycle pedestrian safety kinds of programming. The MPO region has become nationally known as a destination for cyclists. In 2011, Harrisonburg was granted the bronze level rating as a bicycle-friendly community by the League of American Bicyclists. And in 2012, the region was designated the International Mountain Bicycling Association's Ride Center. What that means is we're seeing an awful lot of bicyclists coming in from outside of the region to share the roads. Just this week, Harrisonburg sponsored the Alpine Loop, 105-mile bicycle event that went from Harrisonburg into West Virginia and back with 400 riders. Not surprising, we have a number of bicycle safety and education programs and campaigns, including one of our most successful, which is our Bike Like Ike. Let's see, where are my pictures? There he is. Our Bike Like Ike campaign. Ike is a fictional college student, and he offers safety tips about bicycling, especially targeted to college students. And of course, with the great growth at James Madison University, this is a concern for our region. He's in advertising. You see him on bumper stickers. He's in the Harrisonburg transportation buses, offering safety tips on riding in the valley. And in partnership with the City of Harrisonburg, the Central Shenandoah Planning District Commission, and the MPO, what started as a class project has turned into a regional effort to promote bicycle safety. And here are some additional programs we have, also focusing on bicycle and pedestrian safety for the school systems. The Walmart Bike Smart campaign, and had a lot of success with helmet giveaway. Our MPO has been involved with a number of studies, both current and completed. We have just completed our 2005 long-range transportation plan, which was finalized in March. and also completed a Route 11 South Corridor study. It's one of our major transportation clog areas. The study was completed in April, and it is awaiting adoption with some review by locality. And we're also working on an MPO-wide bike pedestrian study to expand what we've done in the city out into the county and regions. We've had a number of grant programs, and you can see two listed there, transportation enhancement grants that have done beautification projects and sidewalk projects in some of our localities, and then, as I mentioned earlier, our safe routes to school grants for those elementary schools. And we've also been working on enhancing our commuter services, both for people within the region and also people moving beyond the region. One of our challenges is looking, we have a lot of commuters that cross the mountain into Charlottesville, beginning to match them up with rides and looking at some of those programs there for commuter assistance. Multi-use trails or shared use trails are built to accommodate bicyclists, walkers, joggers, wheelchairs, and strollers. We know we need more of these family-friendly routes for novices, recreational cyclists, families with children, and increasingly so as our region more and more becomes an area for tourist traffic. Many of the community parks have bike paths and trails within the park. And we are working to make connections between these and other paths in other areas in the region. And you see one highlighted here, the Bluestone Trail. Our major roadway construction projects move between the county and the city. And the Erickson Avenue Stone Spring Road Connector is a southeast connector that moves in the southern part of the city to move traffic coming in from 33 around 81 and back to the western side of the city. And it has been a major partnership between the city of Harrisonburg and the county of Rockingham and is in its final stages now. The other roadway construction project that is on the horizon is the Reservoir Street project. And this is going to form an important link between Rockingham County and, again, the southern end of the city with JMTU and downtown Harrisonburg and provide important access to the new Rockingham Memorial Hospital. The hospital was positioned on Port Republic Road, which gives it some easy access to Route 81. But it needs now some additional infrastructure to make the road into the hospital more easily accessible from Route 33. And that's what I have for you today. I'd be happy to hear questions.
In listing the county school board as a major factor in the economic climate, and at 1,850 employees for the school board, is it a fair conclusion for me to draw that them roughly 2.5% of the population employed there, that the other players like Merck, CURE, JMU are below that? I'm just curious if a school board, school system is a major part of the economic climate, where do the rest fall in?
No, JMU is a much larger participant in the economic climate. James Madison University, the hospital is a major employer. Merck is further out from the region, but a contributor in that way. But the school board, our MPO is working with the school board on the safe avenues to school as part of the things that we're working on. But certainly the university is a bigger player in that scene.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you for giving us your presentation. You know, it's been very informative. One question I wondered is, has there been any consideration of expanding the MPO to include Augusta, you know, and standing in Waynesboro?
What they're process of doing now, and Bonnie can probably speak to this with a little more detail, is starting a new MPO in that region. So that will be Augusta County, Waynesboro, and Stanton.
Thank you for being with us. Do you have a sense of the agricultural sales? What percentage of that is export?
I don't. Do you?
Just interested in what demands that places on transportation infrastructure, whether it be rail or truck or otherwise.
One of the one of the major employers listed on our list were two distribution centers for Marshalls and Walmart, and the Walmart distribution center covers about 27,000 square feet. It's huge. And so there's a lot of truck traffic in moving goods in and out of the region that way. But I don't know how much of the agricultural sales are turned back into the region and how much of it goes out.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Jennifer DeBrill, Transportation Alternatives.
Typically this time of year you guys are starting to hear from project sponsors for transportation enhancement grants. And as you're aware, we had a new federal transportation bill that was passed earlier this summer, and that made some significant changes to the transportation enhancement program along with the Safe Routes to School program. So I'm going to give you a quick briefing today in the interest of time, but we'd also be happy to answer any questions. At this point, there are probably as many unanswered questions about what the legislation means and how it will be implemented as we have answers. Things keep changing. We're in a regular dialogue with the Federal Highway Administration and participating in their outreach efforts to try to get as much information as we can to pass along to you. Just to give you a quick overview of the Transportation Alternatives Program, it incorporates most of the eligible activities that were in the former Transportation Enhancement Program. It incorporates the Recreational Trails Program, which is actually a program that Federal Highway engages directly with the Department of Conservation and Recreation on. It incorporates the Safe Routes to School Program and also adds a new program having to do with transitioning boulevards. We don't really know anything about that new boulevard program at this time, as that has not been fully defined by Federal Highway. With regard specifically to transportation enhancement, there are four previously eligible transportation enhancement activities that are not specifically included in the MAP 21 legislation. First is the bicycle and pedestrian safety and education. Did receive some clarification late yesterday that will remain eligible for Safe Routes to School projects, but it's no longer eligible as a general transportation enhancement category. Second, the sports put a lot of funding behind acquisition of scenic and historic easements and sites in support of our tourism initiatives. Those are no longer eligible. Neither are the scenic or historic highway programs like the Virginia Civil War Trails Program or transportation museums. The funding also changes. If you look back, and most of MAP 21 is baselined off of fiscal year 2009 allocations. If you look back at fiscal year 2009, we had about $26 million that was set aside specifically with a certain amount for transportation enhancement, a certain amount for Safe Routes to School, and then a certain amount for recreational trails. And those funds were dedicated to those categories and had to be used for those purposes. When you compare that to what is in MAP 21 for transportation alternatives, you now have you still have a mandatory set-aside, or let me change that. You have a set-aside for recreational trails, but the state can opt out of the recreational trails program. At this point, our recommendation is that we remain in that recreational trails program that's managed by DCR. That leaves about $20 million for what had been funded at about $26 million combined for Safe Routes to School and enhancement projects under MAP 21.
The bill also includes some very specific language about how the funds have to be allocated. This is a significant difference from where we have been previously with the Transportation Enhancement Program in particular. If you look at, we're estimating for fiscal year 14 that we'll receive about $22 million in transportation enhancement money. Transportation alternatives. You take about $1.5 million off the top for recreational trails, and then the remainder, $20.5 million, would be broken into two equal shares. Half would go to the MPOs, be allocated based on population, and the law specifically requires that those MPOs, the largest MPOs, that are transportation management areas designated by federal law, which would be six of the MPOs in Virginia, would actually have the authority to choose the projects that are funded under the Transportation Alternatives Program. The remainder of that $10 million for the MPOs would be allocated to other areas of the state based on population. That would leave half, or a little over $10 million, at the discretion of the board. That could be allocated to any area of the state. Unlike the previous Transportation Enhancement Program, that money could actually be transferred all or in part to other highway programs. Before I move off this slide, actually, MAP 21 goes into effect with the fiscal year 13 allocations that you've already made selections for with transportation enhancement based on the applications we received last fall. We've looked at those applications. We've looked at the selections that the board has made. We do have some challenges in that we allocated more money than would be available under transportation alternatives. We did not go through the sub-allocation process, but interestingly enough, if you look at the FY13 allocations, they're split pretty much 50-50 between the MPO areas and the non-MPO areas of the state. And those four transportation management areas received at least as much in allocations for their specific areas as they were entitled to receive under the MAP 21 allocation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Are any of those now ineligible?
There are a few projects that were selected that were ineligible. We do believe that we can take care of that, at least for the selections that the board has already made administratively. I switched some funds around, but some of the projects that fall under the Secretary's tourism initiative, things like the battlefield acquisitions, are no longer eligible.
All right. Thank you.
In terms of what remains eligible for the program, there's actually nine specific categories of projects that remain eligible. The first three all relate to bicycle and pedestrian activities, and this is where the board has historically allocated about 60% of the resources that have been available under transportation enhancement, and this is also where you maintain your eligibility for safe routes to school type projects.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Miller.
I promised Mr. Brewer I would tell the story today, so I'm going to tell it. If you look at the picture on the bottom of the page on the right, that's the high bridge over the Appomattox River. It was a strategic bridge during the Civil War. You can see the old caissons and then the newer caissons, or newer bridge next to it. And I had the unfortunate experience in 1977, 35 years ago, to be on that bridge, and the local authorities didn't think it was a good idea that I should be on the bridge. So we had some conversation about that. And after
what time were you on the bridge?
It was during the day, sir. it was one of those things when you're at Hampton City College that everybody was supposed to go do because it was a beautiful sight, but the local officials didn't think it was a great idea. So after discussing it with the local judiciary one day, we finally got it resolved, and the bottom line was I was very proud to be able to vote for enhancement funds to open this bridge to the public so I can go on at any darn time I want now. It's a beautiful bridge.
And,
but,
Mr. Miller, I'm happy to say that as of this summer, you can go out there legally.
Yeah, I was invited to the opening, and I really wanted to go. I couldn't be there, but it has great sentimental value to me 35 years ago. So I've told the story, Mr. Gould.
Fully closed, though, this time, right?
Mr. Lane.
How nice, Mr. Miller.
Give us a lot of information there.
We very much
all
appreciate
right.
you sharing.
Moving on to our scenic.
Yes, Ms. Lottie.
Before we move on, though, the last point on the previous slide about the conversion of abandoned rail corridors, Are those real? Who owns currently owns those real quarters? Is that has that been transferred to the Commonwealth or?
In the case of the hybrids, the whoever's managing the project has to have control of the right of way. So in the case of the hybrids, it's part of the state park system. So that rail corridor has been transferred to the Commonwealth.
Because the only reason I asked is with earlier discussion on short rail and other future rail concerns, I'm wondering if some of these being converted to other uses, if they can be reconverted if necessary for rail. Once they're done, they're out of the system.
Once they're abandoned and turned into the trail.
Unless there's absolute clarity that there's no future need for those, I just want to make sure we're not going in the wrong direction.
It's really not our province, is it?
That's up to the sponsors. They have to work
with the railroad.
Yeah, they have to work with the railroad to secure that, and they typically do that long before they come to us for anything.
No, but Mr. Lauterbach, I mean, is hits on a very major point, which, you know, the railroads have abandoned thousands and thousands of miles of rail based on things that were happening in the 70s or 80s, and now you go back and look at some of these rails to trails projects. One of them is the W&D in Northern Virginia, which is a perfect for a light rail or heavy rail. Trying to get it back again. Once it's gone, it's gone.
What, Mr. Chairman, what? I'm not familiar, maybe this isn't the time, maybe I can get a briefing later, of how the lines get abandoned and what our role, what the state's role is, or CTB's role is. I guess we don't have to turn it into a trail by using enhancement money, but other than that, do we really have any?
We have no involvement at all. It's a federal program, how do they abandon? I mean, so they do it. I mean, this is part of the insane way the federal taxation works is that it's a disincentive for the railroads to leave tracks out there unused because if it's usable, they get taxed. So they rip up everything, and then they do a federal, like, abandon. A lot of them will own the right-of-way. Like, we bought the right-of-way for the potential for the light rail.
Norfolk Southern right away, $40 million.
So most of the time they own it. Other times they'll turn around and abandon it and turn it over to localities and others to turn it into trails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. CRPT, of course, is very concerned about this and railroads abandoning future lines. And we've met with the railroads because it's very complicated as to how we would create a process to prevent them from doing an abandonment, usually over cost. Maintenance and taxes, as you just heard. Both CSX and Norfolk Southern have assured us they have no intention of doing any future abandonment and that they would let us know that, but we're looking at that thing that's been hanging out there. Do we need a constitutional amendment to be able to purchase anything to do with rail? And we'll be addressing that in this year's General Assembly with what we think the right answer to that is. But I do want you to know that in our agreement for the $75 million ERA funding for the 11 miles of tracks in Quantico, CSX has agreed to give Virginia and North Carolina for their portion of the Old Virginia Railway a seven-year option to purchase that abandoned right-of-way. They own all but 3 miles of it. So we're working on that, and that would be our intention for Virginia to preserve that for the high-speed rail corridor into North Carolina and to bring concepts to you of how to do that and how to best use the entire amount of right of way. So we've got some things in the list.
The next group of eligible activities deals with scenic and historic. There are still some categories of eligibility where we have been able to do promotion and enhancement of the scenic corridors in the past by doing tours and trails. Now we can only do construction of turnouts, overlooks, and viewing areas. Outdoor advertising control remains the same as what was previously eligible under the program. And in terms of historic preservation, now that is limited to preservation and rehabilitation of historic transportation facilities. Previously, we did have the ability to program money to projects that did historic preservation of things that contributed to the transportation system. The last three categories of eligible activities all have to do with environmental and environmental mitigation. The one, number seven, has to do with vegetation management and invasive species. We have received some clarification from Federal Highway. We understood, based on reading the bill, that projects that included landscaping would no longer be eligible under transportation enhancement. As you know, the Gateway project in the city of Richmond has been pretty significant in using transportation enhancement funds for that purpose. We've gotten clarification now that it appears we will be able to continue to do landscaping projects, even though it's not spelled out as eligible.
Excuse me, Ms. Lauderback. I know it's the first one on vegetation management. It brings to mind we haven't done a very good job of preventing invasive species when we plant kudzu to hold back bank erosion, and we know what the results of that has been. So sometimes we have to be careful of the types of things we plant ourselves that we have to try to control in the future. It costs us money.
Another thing that's unique about MAP 21 is all the previous legislation that dealt with transportation enhancement specifically did not spell out who was eligible to apply for the funding. And MAP 21 is very specific, and it spells out which entities would be eligible to apply for funding. There's two really notable things that we see that have been left off the eligible entities list that we're seeking additional clarification on. One, we have a number of large nonprofit organizations like the Civil War Preservation Trust and Journey Through Hallowed Ground we've worked directly with over the years with the Transportation Enhancement Program. We're not sure that they would be eligible to apply on their own under this new program. Also, it specifically excludes state DOTs, so we have asked for some additional clarification on that as well. So really quickly breeze through it, but the new program leaves us with some challenges. Whenever you combine three existing programs that had three separate set-asides, and you have more activities competing for less money. We have to transition to a different selection process, and all of this is in a time frame where we have a two-year transportation bill. Our FY13 allocations have already been applied to projects, and we really only have one more year to implement this bill, assuming that something would come along or continue it after that. We don't know how the eligible entities section is going to impact the enhancement program or the enhancement projects that are underway, and we also have, as you guys are well aware, a considerable backlog of existing projects that are already underway, some of which are not eligible under MAP 21. To give you a very quick status on the enhancement program, if you hear me tripping up and keep going back to transportation enhancement instead of saying transportation alternative, it's because the enhancement program has been around for 20 years, and old habits are very hard to break. Since 1993, the Commonwealth Transportation Board has allocated over $300 million to transportation enhancement projects. We have over 500 completed projects, 104 that are currently under construction, and 259 projects that are in some phase of development. The board's done a fantastic job over the past few years at trying to fully fund phases and fully fund requests so that we can get projects through that pipeline quicker and get them to fruition, but we do still have projects that are on the books that are not fully funded. So when you look at that, if you look at just the next phase to complete the work that's already underway for projects that have been selected, that's about $40 million. We have done a quick analysis of how much of that $40 million is no longer eligible under MAP 21 and found that that was a relatively small number at about $1.7 million. So most of those projects remain eligible to continue to compete for funding. We've also heard Safe Routes to School mentioned a few times. Safe Routes to School is a program that was initiated in 2005 under the previous federal transportation bill. It really has two components. Allocates funds for safety and education to encourage K-8 students to walk to school, and also provides infrastructure grants to actually construct sidewalks to help kids walk and bike to school safely. One difference between Safe Routes to School and transportation enhancement is Safe Routes to School has historically been 100% federally funded, which meant the school districts did not have to come up with any match. Those projects have been done through a technical selection process. They have different terms in their agreements from what we have done with our enhancement projects in the past. Safe Routes to School still has some pre-MAP 21 funding that remains available, so they're getting ready to do a solicitation for projects under the Safe Routes to School program as it existed prior to MAP 21. One round of grants for new infrastructure projects that will be initiated later this month, and also there's a solicitation underway for those by the safety and education components as well. If you look at the Safe Routes to School program, a lot of data on this slide, I won't walk through it, but they've had 65 projects since that program was initiated. I think the big takeaway for this program is that if you look at the history of their grant requests between 2005 and 2012, their requests have outpaced the funding available 2-to-1. So significant demand for this type of project as well. So with all of that information, it kind of leads us to what do we do with the new transportation alternatives program and the Safe Routes to School and enhancement projects that are already underway. We have limited guidance. We have a lot of questions, but at the same time, we're getting pressure from the Federal Highway Administration to keep the projects and the program moving forward. Our recommendation to you would be to go back and adopt an interim FY14 policy for the transportation alternatives program. Give us the ability to go ahead and work through another round of grants to keep the projects moving forward while we learn more about what's going to happen with the program. Some of the considerations in that policy could be how to distribute the funds amongst the board members given the reduced allocation, possibly considering funding only existing projects for fiscal year 14, focus on that backlog, focus on things that we already know are eligible, and also addressing that transferability clause. Our recommendation, and this recommendation has been developed based on suggestions from Federal Highway. Again, they're concerned with keeping the program moving forward, and their recommendation to all the state coordinators has been that there be a consistent eligibility review, application, and selection process for fiscal year 14 while we all collectively try to figure out what the new legislation means and how the sub-allocation will work. Our recommendation is to maintain that single application format and scoring process. We would coordinate with the MPOs that would have allocation authority in doing so. Come back to you in October with a interim policy that would incorporate what we know about MAP 21. VDOT could continue to accept all applications initially to do eligibility reviews and to provide a technical score, much like we've done for the board over the years. We would provide those to the board members and also to the MPOs to facilitate the project selection. If we take that path, proposed schedule for fiscal year 14 would be that we work with the MPOs over the next month. We have reached out to them. We sent them a letter on Friday to start that dialogue, work with them on a proposed application process, bring you an interim policy for consideration next month, which would enable us to do outreach to our sponsors and solicit applications as early as December 1st. The application deadline would be February 1st, again, trying to keep us on the cycle that you would see transportation alternatives projects selected in the time frame lining up with the six-year program so that we could tag onto those public hearings as well. Just in closing and summary, really there's two different parallel processes going on. For the current cycle for fiscal year 14, our recommendation is to do a one-year interim policy to guide the transportation alternative program based on what we know, based on the information that's available, solicit applications for existing projects only so that we can focus on that backlog and clearing the pipeline, and then also, as I already mentioned, solicit applications later this year for new Safe Routes to School projects using that pre-MAP 21 funding. What that means for the Safe Routes to School program is that there is effectively no new allocation or new money available for those projects in fiscal year 13 or fiscal year 14. Looking past FY14, we would work with the board and the MPOs and any other interested parties to develop a new comprehensive transportation alternative CTB policy for implementation with the FY15 cycle. By then, we hope we would have better guidance available. We would really know and understand the new program under MAP 21. With that policy incorporating all eligible transportation alternatives activities, including Safe Routes to School, and also to reopen the program to new applicants. Lot really fast, but
so we're going to call you now that we used to call you the you know, was it the diva? Now you're going to be the diva of doom.
I'll be back soon with good news on revenue sharing. I've got the bad news on the enhancement program.
Mr. Garzinski. Jennifer, in your dialogue, will you make sure emphasize to the MPOs that, you know, this is not of our doing, and we're not just cutting the enhancement program.
My favorite phrase right now is please don't shoot the messenger.
Right.
We've got to deliver the message, and it definitely is a significant change in the federal legislation to a program that's been around for a long time.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Cole.
Mr. Brule, is it likely or possible that these funds would be impacted by sequestration? Or are they out of that realm, would you think?
I think they're deferred to the commissioner. I'm not certain.
We're not certain that. I don't think the
sequestration
will have that much of an impact on it. But I don't know for certain yet.
Okay. They listed, they came out on Friday with a CBO list of what funds in the federal government are going to be impacted. Now, they do have a general highway one in there, but I'm not sure if it's stuff coming out of the trust fund, whether it's the money that they're putting in, because there is a certain portion of the general revenues going into the highway program. So it's nebulous. I know you find that hard to believe, Mr. Cole, that you get something nebulous from the federal government. Yes, Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, this is as much a question to the rest of the board. But considering we're looking at October, perhaps we would consider being sure to include, not necessarily rising to the subcommittee level, but to include some input from at-large and district board representation in coming up with your final, with your recommendations and your format and scoring process.
Agreed. That's fine by me. Is that all right by the board?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Archer.
In some of the districts, like my district, we don't have much of a backlog, so I would be concerned about just doing existing because we really don't have anything. So we may need to take that into consideration more with districts that don't have a backlog. I certainly want the Culpeper District to be able to receive some funding. Or maybe some new projects that are worthwhile.
Right. According to our records, Culpeper District has about $1.4 million in backlog. I think what you may have seen last year is some of those applicants don't apply each year. So
right.
They've got to apply to come back and finish the project. So our expectations are going to finish the project. They may have found other funding sources that we're not aware of.
Right. But we may need to be a little flexible on that.
I think what concerns us with opening it up to new projects is that lengthens the time frame for getting applications because there's a greater outreach involved and a greater education component since the program has changed so significantly, which is why we made the recommendation to proceed with existing projects only.
Yes, Ms. Ball.
Can you go back, Jennifer, to the sub-allocation of funds slot? I want to make sure I understand this.
Okay.
So we take half the money after the rec trails piece, and that would be allocated based on population. And where would that? Who would direct that money?
The allocation based on population for those six MPOs that cover the transportation management areas, those MPOs would make those selections. So Hampton Roads would make selections, the MPO and Hampton Roads would make selections for their set-aside based on population.
And the 6.4 would just come off the top before that happened?
Of the $10 million.
Okay, that's part of it.
That's part of it. The other just under $4 million
goes to non-MPO areas.
That is distributed based on population, but the selections do not have to be made by the MPO. So that may weave back into how we handle the board.
That's what I was trying to get at. So
we're looking for additional clarification, and that's why we didn't bring you a draft policy statement today. We're literally having dialogue with the feds on a weekly basis on the program. So we're hoping that we get some clarification on that, and that may feed back into
I guess we shouldn't be hypothetical, but we'll discuss this before our next meeting. But if we don't get clarification, we have to make a decision.
And it was very interesting for us to look at the allocations that the board made and see that 50-50 split was there
And the, I mean, for an example, Hampton Roads MPO probably receive, I think it was about twice what they would be entitled to if it was divided up based on population.
Because Mr. Lane was very good.
So it was very interesting to us to see that that actually worked out even without the formula in place.
I'd certainly like to be included in this stuff. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. That is the last published item on the workshop, but Mr. Worley has a special guest star. Ms. Pusher, where are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Again, I'm here today to speak to a MAP 21 change that will be occurring effective October 1. And this has to do with adding principal arterial routes to the National Highway System, or NHS. MAP 21 requires the inclusion of non-NHS principal arterials into the NHS, and at the same time, the new authorization is eliminating the statutory mileage cap on the NHS system. The addition of the principal arterials will become effective on October 1, which is the beginning of the federal fiscal year. And FHWA is looking to add VDOT's current non-interstate principal arterials to the NHS. Now, the principal arterials, the largest component of that classification already in the NHS is the interstate system. However, we just received a directive September 5th with a due date of September 20th where the FHWA has given VDOT until September 20th to add to the principal arterial network using the NHS operational and connectivity criteria. So automatically they would have added what was already classified as a principal arterial that was not already in NHS, but they're allowing us in the short window of opportunity to see what road routes we might actually upgrade to principal arterials and add to NHS. Now, any classification changes for roadways in urban areas do require cooperation with the MPO responsible for the area where the roadway may be located. But due to the short turnaround time related to this directive, our submittals will be taken into the NHS subject to the expected MPO coordination for changes in the urbanized areas after the effective date. VDOT's already halfway through a functional classification review based on the 2010 census. So basically, with each census every 10 years, we do update the functional classification of our roadways. With the request from FHWA to provide any updates to our principal arterial network by the 20th, which is tomorrow, we have accelerated our review based on the current process that we're going through, and we're working with the VDOT district staff, we have been over the last couple of days, to look at some initial recommendations for changes to the principal arterial roadways to be added to the NHS effective October 1. Our preliminary findings indicate that we're looking to include a net addition of approximately 360 miles of newly classified principal arterials. So we've got some roadways we're looking to upgrade and some that we would be looking to downgrade to be included in the NHS. Now, overall, what makes this the additions to the NHS system important is the new funding structure related to MAP 21. They've taken a lot of funding programs and reduced it into fewer programs, and the funding is more flexible within that funding program. So we would be looking to add the more lane mileage to the NH system, which is now going to be included in what's called the National Highway Performance Program, or NHPP.
this program combines the previous safety loop funding programs of the interstate maintenance, NHS, and Bridge, and the combined funding program, NHPP, will receive about 64% of the federal funding we will receive under MAP 21. NHPP, if you look it up in MAP 21, is defined as providing support for the condition and performance of the National Highway System for the construction of new facilities and to ensure that investments of federal funds are directed to support progress to the achievement of performance targets. MAP 21 is including now performance targets for the maintenance and construction of highway projects. Now, our next steps will be to provide FHWA with our list of proposed changes tomorrow, and then we will need to work with the MPOs and other localities over the next few months. We're looking to complete our classification review in February to March of 2013. So we will be working with the MPOs to finalize those changes that we're recommending for October 1, and we have the ability to go back in and make any corrections or changes that we'll need to make based on that completed update at that time. Now, with regard to performance measures, FHWA and the USDOT has 18 months to provide guidance on performance measures for the NHPP and the other MAP 21 funding programs. And then the DOTs have 12 months to get back with Federal Highways on what those specific DOT targets will be. So I just needed to bring you up to date on what was happening quickly to be effective October 1.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
We just wanted to let you know we would have given you a detailed presentation. This was something that just happened. We didn't have time to give you a presentation, but we will bring this back to you in October. But we wanted to let you know because this will impact some of the localities and the MPOs, and we'll have further detail on that at the next meeting.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
That will require our vote to make these classification changes.
No, sir.
It will not.
She's doing it tomorrow.
I understand, but you said
But we would. They have to be approved. Any changes would have to be approved by FHWA. But we would absolutely bring you back the detailed information. We follow the classification guidelines that are put out by the Federal Highway Administration.
So these are federal roads.
Yes.
So therefore, do not require our approval in and out of the program.
Well, wait. It's two separate things.
Yeah,
so our we take secondary, primary.
Right.
We have our own classification.
Yes.
This is the federal classification, which
federal
we actually don't vote on.
Also, okay, fine.
Yeah, this is not, Mr. Chairman, they're not all federal roads. They're just in the national highway system.
That's right.
Okay.
That's correct.
That's right. So this is the opportunity.
And what are the pros and cons of having arterial in the national highway system versus not?
Eligibility for federal
funding.
And that's one of the things that we want to come back with a more detailed presentation on. But we just want you to know we were working on that, and because of the tight timetables and the short request, we were submitting something without your
right.
presentation to you. But we'll come back in October and present those pros and cons.
Just to follow up, because I know you're taking some, you're recommending they take some out and put some in. So if you take it out, so it's no longer eligible for federal highway.
They would still be eligible for federal funding, but it wouldn't be classified as part of the NHPP funding category.
So we would take them out because we should, or because there's a benefit to, or because?
Because I believe the complication of the performance measure
because we should. They don't meet the requirements.
That's right.
They meet the requirements.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can we be sent a copy of what was sent to FHWA so we see which roads are involved?
I think we should probably go through and work. I mean, it's a detailed listing, and we would have to call that down to make it, you know, in a readable fashion for you or digestible way. So we will get you some information.
Okay. I assume ultimately we'll have the final decision in the six-year plan deliberations as to who gets money and who doesn't, no matter what their what category they're put in, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Absolutely.
We would have the final decision when we approve the six-year plan as to who gets money and who doesn't, notwithstanding these federal bureaucrats. Okay.
And if you're interested in the meantime, there's an easy way to see what they are by just Googling it.
Oh, really?
You can see where they are. I'm looking at them right now. The ones that are current.
Oh, the current ones.
So you got a current map.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Ms. Buescher, thank you very much. Okay. This brings to a conclusion the workshop, and now we